This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 16th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 121. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, I continue with this month's special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. I'll look at what went on during the 10th anniversary of opening day on February 12th. But first, highlights from my appearance on Mike Klassen's Vancouver Overcast podcast, looking back at Vancouver 2010.
Hey, this is Mike Klassen, and welcome to Vancouver Overcast, a podcast where we have conversations with city leaders and innovators. It was 10 years ago this month that Vancouver, British Columbia hosted the world at the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Games. Many have described the 2010 Olympics as Canada's defining moment on the world stage. Behind the scenes, though, tensions ran high. The public were grumpy, too, as city officials warned citizens to avoid the traffic and stay home. However, in the end, a bit of a miracle happened. In spite of the economic collapse that preceded it and the tragic passing of an athlete at the start of competition, Vancouver's 2010 Games became a smash success. In the second part of this two-part conversation with journalist Bob Mackin, we discuss the pressure cooker days of the Games, and we also ask, would it ever happen again? And now, it's time for Vancouver Overcast.
As they always say with an Olympics, no matter how many controversies they are, it's always the athletes that save the Games. No matter how many controversies there are coming into the Games, those controversies often just get pushed to the side or delayed until after the Games. But then the athletes take over because these are the people that really should be at the center of the Games. The Games should be a sporting event. They've been bastardized in so many ways by political agendas, by corporate agendas, and of course the security overlay, all these fears. But when the athletes actually start performing and excelling and succeeding and winning, and those are the stories that we all come for that draw us to the Olympics at the start.
So Bob, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a little break. You're listening to Vancouver Overcast. My guest is Bob Mackin from the Breaker.News. We're talking about the kind of run up to the 2010 Games and what happened. I'd like to spend a few minutes with Bob as we close out to talk about the event itself and what happened and perhaps what's next for the city. So we're talking to Bob Mackin from the Breaker.News. Clearly, Bob, having attended about four or five different Olympic events and as well kind of following the story of what happened in BC for over 20 years, it's really interesting for me to go back and to recollect all of these incredible things. Really, what really dawns on me in our conversation is just how many things could have gone completely wrong that have derailed the Games yet. And I guess it's a credit to the leadership. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism over the years about looking back on the Games. But I think the fact that they were able to pull it off in spite of so many potential things in this multi-billion dollar exercise, this big, huge event. And in the end, the torch relay wound up here. We had the opening ceremonies. We had the glitches with the props at the BC Place. We had those beautiful opening performances, those beautiful closing performances. And on the streets of the city, something happened. People started coming downtown. Some, as you said earlier, we had freak weather. We had this lovely, pleasant, dry for the most part. There was only a couple of days I remember it raining. And people just came out and they would line up for hours for the Zip Trek, for the Royal Canadian Mint Museum, to the Ontario Pavilion, to go through the BC Pavilion. My gosh, I mean, it was unbelievable. And then to see all the communities around Metro Vancouver, all the way from Whistler to the North Shore, to Abbotsford, to Surrey, to Richmond, and have all of these local events taking place where people came out of their homes and got to celebrate during that time. There was a magic in the air. There really was, I thought.
Well, there was, but it almost even didn't happen on the first weekend because the first day of the Games, there was a sadness in the air. Something happened at the Vancouver Olympics that doesn't happen at every Olympics, that had never happened on the opening day of an Olympics. an athlete died. Nordar Kermitashvili, the 21-year-old loser, in his last training run at the Whistler Sliding Center, flew off his sled near the end of the run. And I still remember there was another Sun Media reporter actually up in Whistler covering it, but I remember getting the news bulletin and finding the clip just a matter of minutes later on YouTube. I mean, everything at the Olympics, because of the Olympic broadcast system, even the training runs was, because the broadcasters had to do their own training runs, was on video. And, you know, the rights holding broadcasters from around the world had access to it. And someone had taken that clip and put it on YouTube. So after getting the bulletin, not long after that, I was able to see it and then hear the clank of the contact of Nordar Kermitashvili's helmet and the exposed steel pole. And so that unleashed a sadness and unleashed a crisis communications plan. And suddenly the suits that everyone was wearing in the main delegation for the IOC in Vanok became black suits, the kind of suits you'd wear at a funeral. The Georgian team, however small it was, wearing black armbands, did their walk along with the other nations that were introduced at BC Place Stadium. And you could tell that they were carrying the weight of the world. One of their teammates who they had flown to Vancouver with, who some of them had seen the night before, was not with them. And you could see the sadness in their eyes. And as they walked around BC Place, every single section stood up, standing ovation and clapping just to give them some sort of emotional lift after the unthinkable. And of course, we found out after the games, and I'd done some stories on it as well, that that was really preventable. This wasn't the athlete's fault. This was a problem with the engineering of the venue, of the way it was built. And Vanok even knew it about a year before, because athletes' speeds were far beyond what the engineer had calculated. Mm. And there was a problem that they didn't fix. So that's one big black mark on the games. Yeah. That isn't on other games. In fact, the last time I went to an IOC meeting in 2016 at Rio Games, they actually had a moment of silence to remember that. They will always remember that, and they always should remember that, and we should not forget it either, because that was one that may have been part of the problem, that Vanok was not prepared for the economic crisis, and then when the economic crisis came, that became the be-all and end-all, and some other things slipped their mind. And I'm sure they'd love to go back in a time machine as well, and not only have a better business plan, but also to fix the finer elements when they were told by the engineer and the architect of the sliding center a year before that, hey, something's wrong here, you got to fix it. So that was a problem. And that really did cast a pall over the first weekend, with the bad weather, with the buses at Cyprus not working properly, with the international media pointing out all the problems in Vancouver.
That was my appearance on the Vancouver Overcast podcast, hosted by Mike Klassen. Check out the Vancouver Overcast podcast. Listen to part one and part two of my conversation with Mike. It is on multiple podcast platforms, and the easiest way to check it out is to go to mikeklassen.net. It's all about Vancouver leaders and innovators. That's Mike, KLASSEN.net.
British Columbia, 2010.
You gotta be here.
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 On February 12th, the 10th anniversary of opening day of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics, the cauldron at Jack Poole Plaza was relit. And in Whistler Village, a memorial service for Nordar Kermitashvili 10 years after the tragic death of the Georgian loser at the Whistler Sliding Center. On February 12th, 10 years after the 2010 Winter Olympics opened in Vancouver, the cauldron on Jack Poole Plaza was relit to the sound of O Canada. Under sunny skies in Whistler Village, a procession on the village stroll to the Olympic Plaza. The reason was the 10th anniversary of the fatal crash on the Whistler Sliding Center that claimed the life of 21-year-old Georgian luger Nodor Kmitashvili. Konstantin Kaftaradze, the Georgian ambassador to Canada, laid flowers on the memorial plaque. He was joined by Terence Kozakar. Kozakar was the first track medic on scene when Kmitashvili crashed on his final training run. Also among the speakers was Mo Douglas, former community relations director with the Vancouver 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games Organizing Committee, also known as FANOC.
We are here also to celebrate. To celebrate life of this young, brave, Georgian man who came here to be a champion. Very ambitious man. When he didn't have facilities in Georgia, he traveled to Austria and Germany to train. And through 2008, 2009 cycle of World Cups, he gave everything he had in order to qualify for the Olympic Games. He did it, he came here, and his willingness, his inspiration inspired a lot of people around the world, here in Whistler, in Vancouver, in Canada, in Georgia.
Kozakar remembered the first time he met Kmitashvili, when the luger had a minor crash the previous season.
He had an accident further up the track, where he came on down into 16, and hey, EMR 10-7 on it, and myself and our team jumped in to help him out, and offered him a ride back up to the start, and he just looked at us with those eyes. Ice off of his suit, and he walked up, determined. The next time, the next day, the same thing happened. But he got in the vehicle, and I drove him up to the way down. And it was the most beautiful thing, because I looked at him, I said, "You got this, brother. Hey, my name's Terence Kozakar." And he didn't even shake my hand. He gave me a fist pump out of respect because he had spikes on his fingers. That's what I remember most.
It was a day that changed a lot of our lives and did make a lot of days challenging, but in my mind, he's a hero and he'll be a legend, and I'm so proud that Whistler embraced that. It's part of our Olympic history, and it's actually pretty amazing to be here today and hear the amount of understanding of celebration of what his achievements were and what tragedy sometimes can make happen, which is often incredibly positive outcomes. So thank you for being here, and he's in my heart more than February 12th.
The Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics were supposed to herald a new era for Canada's Indigenous peoples. Leaders of the four host First Nations, the Squamish, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Lillooet, got VIP access to the Games after being part of the organization and gaining economic benefits for their First Nations along the way. The Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh have stuck together after the Games. They have become major players in real estate and have political clout that they did not have before Vancouver 2010. But many of Canada's tribes continue to struggle with poverty and governance issues. 10 years after the Games, the biggest national story right now is the protests against the Coastal GasLink pipeline through traditional Wet'suwet'en territory in central BC. The elected band council supports the pipeline, but the hereditary chiefs do not. A judge banned their blockade and the RCMP moved in to make arrests. That sparked the Shut Down Canada protest movement that has snarled bridges and railways throughout the country. If you remember Vancouver 2010, protesters tried to tie up traffic on the first couple of days in a bid to stop the Games. They delayed four host First Nations chiefs and other politicians from arriving at the opening ceremony, but they didn't derail any of the events. On February 11th in Victoria, protesters supporting the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs tried to stop the throne speech at the legislature. They didn't succeed, as Lieutenant Governor Janet Austin found her way into the building through a secret entrance. But not before protesters surrounded the legislature and denied access to not only politicians, but members of the press gallery and staff of the legislature. In this clip from the Twitter feed of Sean Craig, protesters with their arms linked block Richard Zussman of Global News from walking up the stairs. He eventually climbed from the side of the stairs to get into the building. Police later arrived at the legislature to ensure safe passage for those who needed to be in the building. Later that day in Vancouver, protesters blocked Cambie and Broadway. That lasted until 6 a.m. the following morning. Meanwhile, protesters swarmed into Attorney General David Eby's Point Grey riding office on February 13th. One of his aides needed police escort to remove sensitive documents. By late afternoon, protesters had left, while others blocked the West Coast Express tracks in Port Coquitlam overnight, canceling morning service. Protest leader Natalie Knight, and sounds from David Eby's office.
Law and put pressure on the government to immediately withdraw the RCMP from Wet'suwet'en territories.
How long do you plan on staying here?
We will be here until David Eby meets with us.
The incidents sparked question period debate. Here is Richmond Queensborough BC Liberal MLA Jazz Johal and NDP Premier John Horgan on February 13th.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You know, what we have witnessed the last few days is not some spontaneous uprising, but a well-funded and coordinated national strategy to shut down vital infrastructure and inconvenience the public. Presently, protesters are blockading a road at UBC, and initial reports also show that protesters have entered the Attorney General's constituency office. My understanding is his constituency assistant needed a police escort to remove sensitive documents from his office. So the Attorney General has lost control of his community office to radical activists. These same activists also disrupted goods and services and people at the Swartz Bay Terminal on January 20th, Delta Port and Port of Vancouver February 8th and 9th, Vancouver City Hall February 9th, Johnson Street Bridge and Bay Street Bridge February 10th, Helijet Victoria Terminal February 11th, Vancouver Cambie Intersection February 11th, Granville Street Bridge yesterday, and tomorrow we have a planned shutdown of government offices. It doesn't end there, Mr. Speaker. I have a letter here from Ken Veldman. He's Vice President at the Prince Rupert Port. That port has been severely impacted by these very actions as well. So I want to read a quote from his letter. He says, quote, "Operations are being wound down at the port of Prince Rupert, with terminals receiving no rail and working with current cargoes on hand and capacities available. Terminal operations are being severely curtailed. Labour is not being called in, and the situation is expected to deteriorate even more in the next couple of days, and will likely cascade into BC and Canadian exporters curtailing operations in multiple industries, including mills and mines. Moreover, full recovery of the terminals, gateway and railway network from this disruption will take months, even after service is resumed." End quote. Mr. Speaker, to this Premier, I would say, his job is not a passive role. He's not passive at all. Preserving the rule of law is his responsibility. Will the Premier stand up for the hardworking men and women of BC and bring back the rule of law?
Premier.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. And I guess the word of the day for the Liberals on their word of the day calendar was passive, because I've heard it a few times. And I just want to say to all members of this House and all British Columbians that I don't believe there's a person in this room who doesn't believe that unlawful behaviour requires consequences. And I think everyone also understands that law enforcement, in the face of illegal behavior, has every tool at their disposal to take action. With respect to the port of Prince Rupert, a federal port, I have been in contact with the Deputy Prime Minister last evening. I'll be speaking with the Prime Minister at the end of question period today. And together we have reached out to the Gitxsan leadership and urged them to leave the tracks. The CN Rail Company has sought an injunction, as they rightly should. Again, I believe every step is being taken to preserve lawful behavior in British Columbia. And it does not in any way. In any way assist the people of British Columbia to have an opposition that prefers to give an inventory of illegal behavior and say, what's the deal with that? If they just woke up yesterday, sometimes, Honourable Speaker, when I think of things like ICBC, when I think of how they drove that corporation into the ground, and they go, hey, it wasn't us, we just showed up 2 years ago. We just arrived 2 years ago. These issues have been percolating for generations, and I think it's appropriate for reasonable leaders
Members.
To band together to say with one voice, illegal behavior is unacceptable. Let law enforcement do its job. Let the courts do what they're supposed to do, and we'll move on from there. But it does not help. When a pathetic opposition tries to find a way to sow discontent rather than to find the harmony that, again, I thought we had not that many months ago.
Later on February 13th, Speaker Darrell Plekis sent a lawyer to the BC Supreme Court and was granted an injunction to stop any protests from blocking doors. Here is Alan Mullen, Chief of Staff to Speaker Darrell Plekis.
It was quite surreal, really, looking out my office window, seeing lines of protesters linking arms, some of their faces covered, chanting and banging drums. But then when it escalated to, some of our staff from our office entering the building, being harassed and screamed at and, sort of people getting in their faces. That became then, in my mind, not really a peaceful protest. I did witness a Minister of the Crown also having her personal space invaded. And obviously, as I think everybody knows by now, we did receive reports of people being assaulted. So it was quite a surreal situation, though, to be inside that building and essentially try and get our staff and other staff into the building safely.
Now, the Lieutenant Governor eventually did get into the building through a secret entrance and do her important job, which is to start the new session of the legislature, which was the reason for the legislative meeting on February 11th. After that, the protests eventually did dissipate, but Speaker Darrell Plekis had a lawyer go to court and receive an injunction to restrict future protests, to make sure there is no behavior like that of intimidation or blocking of people. Tell me more about the injunction.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the Speaker and I think everybody are the greatest fans of the democratic right to protest. That is not what's at issue here. We are saying, come to the legislature, come to the precinct and have your demonstrations, have your peaceful protests. But we felt it was necessary, and the Speaker felt it was necessary to get the injunction. And what that injunction says is, you're more than welcome to come to the legislature and protest, but what you're not welcome to do is to be blocking entrances and exits, which is exactly what we saw on Tuesday. That creates a serious hazard, obviously a fire hazard, an emergency hazard if people are trying to get in or out of that building. So that injunction clearly states that any person that blocks doors or impedes those doorways for people coming in or out are in direct violation of that injunction and are subject to immediate removal and or arrest.
Now, various government ministry offices around Victoria were picketed by some of the same people and the same cause on February 14th. Were there any major incidents there, anything remarkable on that day?
No, we haven't heard of any major incidents to speak of. It seems that it was certainly smaller groups at those ministry and government offices, and it seems that they were not impeding people from, coming or going from those buildings. It was more, trying to garner support from passing vehicles, honk their horns and that kind of stuff, and they had signage, but they weren't, trying to block people's access, which they were doing at the legislature on Tuesday.
On February 15th, protesters blocked the CN rail tracks in East Vancouver near the Renfrew SkyTrain station. That meant cancellation of twice-daily Amtrak Cascades rail service to and from Seattle. Last month, Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, used his power to reroute a pipeline around Aboriginal land in his country, even if taxpayers are stuck with the bill. That pipeline? It's going to be built by the same company that wants to build Coastal GasLink. Will Prime Minister Justin Trudeau do the same in BC? Stay tuned. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the thousands and thousands of Blue Jackets from Vancouver 2010. The volunteers from all walks of life who wore blue jackets and helped stage the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics and Paralympics 10 years ago. Whether they were working in first aid or just helping visitors get around, thank you for your service. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 16th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on February 16th in 2010, Mayle Ricker won the Women's Snowboard Cross gold medal for Canada at the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics? Ricker was the first Canadian woman to win Olympic gold on Canadian soil. The North Vancouver-born Ricker became an Olympic champion in West Vancouver at Cypress Mountain. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.